Once more under the breach, dear friends. Health fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff McClure. Jake is normally the co-star or pro-star or whatever of this program. However, he is off wandering around in the nation he lovingly refers to as America's Cap, otherwise known as Canada. Actually, it just indicates that he's a lot smarter than I am because it's cool up there and it's not cool down here. So Jake's off being cool and Jeff's down here on the radio. So if you'd like to give us a call and stimulate my aging mind that's going sour talking to a green phone ball, you're certainly welcome to do so. The telephone number is 254-773-1400. Started talking last hour about something that is locally significant, and that is Encore. For those of you who are not familiar with Encore, it is the company that owns almost all of the power lines in the state of Texas. Encore, and I'm going to leave some entities out of this thing and keep it simple. If you want the newsletter, it's got all the names of the companies involved. But Encore was bought by a consortium of investors. TXU was bought by a consortium of investors led by KKR, which is a takeover leveraged buyout firm. And they bought it and they borrowed a tremendous amount of money to buy it. And one of the reasons they leveraged it and thought they were getting such a good deal is because TXU owns some really large coal reserves in Texas. And you probably didn't know there were coal reserves in Texas, but there's some big ones. And also was one of the largest owners of natural gas reserves in the nation. The assumption that KKR and Goldman Sachs and everybody else who got involved in this made was that the price of those fuels would go up because the price of oil was up. And they thought that everything would be fine and they would be able to pay back their investors very high interest rates because the bonds they issued were high risk, called high yield bonds. We call them junk bonds. And it turned out that it didn't work that way. Of course, the price of, with the advent of fracking and the advent of all the natural gas that came out of fracking, the price of fuel dropped like a rock. And as fuel costs drop, the competition for electricity caused the fact that we now have a pretty free market in Texas for electricity, caused the price of electricity to drop, which caused the percentage that could be charged by Encore to transmit that electricity over its line to be worth less money. And as a result, the Energy Futures Corporation that bought TXU went bankrupt. And Encore was one of their biggest assets. The power generation side of it has already been spun off, and everybody is relatively happy. But the transmission line side, which is the big one, which is a monopoly in effect, has remained in bankruptcy, and the shareholders aren't going to get any money. The bondholders are waiting patiently to see how much money they'll get on their junk bonds, whether they'll get 20 cents on the dollar or 30 or whatever they're going to get. Interesting thing came up. Now, Encore, and I had to hunt around for this a little bit, when it was split off from TXU, was worth $25 billion, apparently, at the time. And this doesn't take into account the fuels and the fossils, fuels here and there and everything else. This is strictly the power lines in the state of Texas. And they've added power lines since then. So Encore, back a few years ago, was theoretically worth $25 billion. There have been a couple of bids for it in bankruptcy of $18.4 billion. But the Texas Utilities Commission turned them down. And the reason they turned them down was because once burned, twice wary. The buyers were going to float a big bunch of bonds, sell the bonds, then the people who own the bonds take the risk, and the buyer walks away with a bunch of money. But the problem was, and is, that these are relatively high-risk bonds. They are paying an above market interest rate that they're the bonds they want to sell, which means that the money that we pay here in Texas to have energy transmitted over the power lines would mainly be going to bondholders, which sounds like good capitalist something or another. But here's the problem with that, and this is one of those issues where a little regulation may be a good thing. Those power lines require maintenance, and they require expansion as Texas grows, which means that if the company that owns the power lines has a lot of debt, a lot of bond issuance, and is having to make some high interest debt payments, and things slow down a little bit, we could be in a position where the power lines in the state of Texas don't get fixed very fast, and they don't get maintained properly, and they don't get expanded when they need to expand. So the Texas Public Utilities Commission did what I think was a smart thing and turned down the $18 billion offer for what was just a few years ago $25 billion worth of power lines. Warren Buffett this week came in with a $9 billion, I said that right, $9 billion offer for Oncor. The difference is he's willing to ante up cash. And this is causing some fits and anger among bidders, and you may see some counterbids come in. But the bottom line to it is the Texas Utilities Commission has got, I think, 60 days to determine whether they will accept that offer. And the interesting thing is they don't get the $9 billion. The bondholders get the $9 billion, and you don't have to do a lot of fancy math to realize that if somebody paid $25 billion for something, and then when it goes bankrupt, they get $9 billion in return, that the bondholders are not going to be doing very well. Ironically, Berkshire Hathaway, the company that is chaired and CEO'd by Warren Buffett, early bought some of those bonds, lost a lot of money on them, sold them on the open market before the company went bankrupt, and Warren Buffett has said it's one of the worst investment decisions he ever made. Now he's wants to come in and buy not the energy assets, but the power transmission assets of the old TXU. Now, why is that significant? Warren Buffett does not make dumb moves. He buys some things occasionally that he then, like bonds, that he then sells, and he may lose a little money, but the big bets he makes when he buys whole companies are really profoundly predictive of what's going to happen next. The railroad industry was in deep trouble years ago, and Warren Buffett bought Burlington Northern and he hasn't sold Burlington Northern, so he hasn't actually recovered a great deal of money, but we've seen the railroads pick up tremendously since then. He looked at the railroad situation in the United States and determined it just needed a little more money. And he gave them the money, they fixed up their rails, and they've been doing very, very well. And that's kind of the story of Berkshire Hathaway over the years. When they go in and buy an entire company, the company tends to do well into the future because they really do their homework before they buy the company. Now, what is that got to do with us? Well, actually, it's a really good thing if because the Texas Utilities Commission, one of the reasons that the bid was so low, $9 billion, is that the Texas Utilities Commission has demanded that any buyer of Oncor ring fence it, which you probably never heard of. But basically, it says you won't pay out high dividends, you won't do stock buybacks or anything else to benefit the shareholders excessively. You'll pay reasonable dividends on preferred stock to shareholders, which utilities companies do, but you won't pay high dividends, and they will be regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. The reason they want that is they want Oncor to build up some very large cash reserves and do a lot of reinvestment. And factually, what we've seen across Texas is since the bankruptcy, less than full maintenance is being done on the big power lines. And we're not and what Warren Buffett has said, okay, I'll come in and pay half of what your previous bid was, but I will reinvest the income and keep the power lines in good condition and expand them and basically invest in the company as we go along. Presently, I sincerely hope he gets it, and I think it will be in everybody's best interest, but it's a good thing for Texas. Now, besides that, what does it mean? It means that he expects that even after making those promises, there will be a sufficient growth in power usage in the state of Texas that the fees that are paid to use those power lines will continue to climb at an above-market rate. Now, combine that with something else I mentioned last hour, and I think it becomes sort of significant. There's 100 more oil drilling rigs now drilling for oil, fracking, in the central United States than there was in April. Throw a third thing in. Oil exploration budgets around the world, if we take Total and BP and Exxon and everybody else who does global oil exploration, by exploration I mean hunting for new oil, those budgets have been cut on average about 20% from where they were a couple of years ago. And the oil exploration is being pulled back around the rest of the world. Here in the United States, there is a clear bet being made by sophisticated, successful investors that we're going to see more energy usage in the United States in the future. And it is profitable to hunt for it and to transmit it specifically in the form of electricity. That is saying to me that Warren Buffett and major investors, institutional investors, that do a lot of research and operate very quietly, and those are the ones that are obviously the most effective, I say obviously, those are the ones that make the big headlines and make the big splashes, may or may not be effective, who knows. But I can say that the ones that are very quiet investors are the ones that bear watching. And as they do this, they are making a bet, in effect, that over the next 10 to 15 years, the United States economy will continue to grow at a reasonable rate and continue to see real growth in the total economy that will require increased energy usage. Now, why is that important? If you're a long-term investor, and I hope that if you're listening to this, you are, then you are making the same bet. If you're investing, for example, in major, a big part of your portfolio is in equities. Equities are the collective stocks of companies that are publicly traded in the United States. If you're largely invested in that, one of the things you're making, in essence, a bet on is we're not about to have another great recession or a depression. You're saying, I believe that the corporations in the United States are going to continue to grow their earnings, to grow their size, and to be dominant in the world, which they are right now. If that's a correct bet, you will do very, very well going into the future. If we had another 1929, another 1973, or even another 2007 with the market crash that went with it, your bet wouldn't look so good. And I really believe in looking at these things. And you could say, well, Warren Buffett's always investing, and sometimes the market goes up, sometimes it goes down. I will say that there have been a couple of times in history Warren Buffett basically has backed out of investing because he said stock prices were high enough. He did that just before the 1973 fall in the market. The 1973 fall in the market took a long time to recover from. And he said in 2000 that he just didn't understand how the market could be so high and said negative things about the market and stopped buying things. 1999 and 2000, he didn't buy anything. He just sat quiet and went more and more conservative, held more and more cash. And now he is buying which is a powerful indication to me that he believes that the United States economy is in good shape and will continue to be in good shape going forward. Okay, let's talk about the news that came out this week a little bit. Again, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. You're listening to Jeff McClure. Jake's not here today. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to join me. June jobs report. Pretty interesting jobs report, to say the least. It is a powerful indicator of what's going on in the real economy. We created 222,000 jobs. That's the first estimate. There was another 47,000 jobs you can throw in there because they revised the previous 2 months' estimates up for a total of 47,000 jobs. So what we actually saw with this release is 222 plus 47. And last time I looked, that was like 269, nearly 270 new jobs created, announced this week. And I say new jobs created. That is a net employment gain. There's still layoffs going on. There's still a couple hundred thousand weeks per week of people getting laid off. That happens. And there's new job openings being filled. That happens. The net is what we get on this employment report. And that net says that about 250,000 more people are working now than were before. As a matter of fact, if you actually run this out over the last year, we're looking at 2.1 million more people, maybe more, who are working that weren't working, and they're getting, admittedly, not a big pay raise, 25 cents an hour more than they were making last year. So when you add all this together, you come up with some really interesting, observation. The unemployment rate rose to 4.4% with this announcement. Previously, it was 4.3. So what we had is we have about somewhere between 75 and 125,000 people a month come into the job market out of school. So if we're running around 100,000 people a month on average over a long term, new employees, new positions filled with new employees, then we are at a break-even point. When we've averaged 180,000 per month, as we have over the last 6 months, we are hiring more people than are coming into the hiring market out of school. We're hiring a lot more people. We're approaching twice the number of people by some estimates. But at least we're hiring a significant number of people who previously were unemployed. And as a result, we have about roughly 643,000 people fewer looking for jobs today than at the beginning of the year. What does all this mean? It means that businesses are expanding. They're hiring people across the board from one end of the country to the other. Now, this particular jobs report came in considerably higher than economists had expected. And when we look at it, there are some interesting factors in there. The two biggest hiring sources over the last several years have been, actually over the last this year, have been municipalities and medical. Now we got this, and hold that thought for just a moment. And recognize that there's a conundrum going on out there. The conundrum is at 4.3% or 4.4% unemployment, with us hiring this many people, we're approaching or at full employment, meaning that just about anybody who wants a job can find a job. There are exceptions to that. There are certain places in the country, and there's about 25% of the people who are out of work in the United States who are the hardcore unemployed, who've been unemployed for 27 months or more and are still looking for work. Geographically, there are some places, Detroit kind of stands out as an obvious one, where there are more people looking for work than there are people working. On the other hand, we're seeing an increasing migration across the United States as people give up and move to where the jobs are, which basically is in the western United States. So why haven't we seen wages go up? And amazingly enough, the answer is largely to be found in those two items I mentioned before. In a normal free market situation, wages can be raised to attract more employees. But if your primary funding is governmental and is set by legislature or school board or whatever, you can't raise wages. You have to try to find some other way of attracting employees. And if you think again, education, public education in the United States, they can't, the principal or the school superintendent can't just say, oh, okay, we don't have enough teachers, let's raise their wages. Doesn't work that way. They can't do it. The same thing is true in the medical world. The primary funding source for the medical institutions across the country are a combination of Medicare, to some degree Medicaid, and insurance companies. And they are really, they have a set price. It's generally the Medicare price is the price that they will pay for something. And that is set at the federal government level. So you're in a position where if Scott and White is short employees, they can't say, well, let's just give everybody let's give new employees a 20% raise, and that way we can hire a bunch of people. Or let's give our existing employees a 20% raise so they don't leave. You can't do that because their source of income is fixed. This is a good, this is a perhaps an answer for a couple of things. One, why we are not seeing wages go up, and two, why we're not seeing inflation go up. What the end result of this will be, I'm really not smart enough to know. I can say that as the job shortage becomes more and more acute, and it is becoming acute across the board, employers are reporting again and again and again, they can't find skilled people to do the work. The skills are missing. The education system is not oriented on providing the skills that are needed to for people to go to work, which is mainly right now critical thinking skills. Those have been declining. And so we're getting an issue across the board that eventually will pop something somewhere and we'll get moving. What's happening in businesses, and I can say this from running a business for many, many years now, is that when we hire people, we no longer expect that those people will know how to work in our business. We no longer expect, and at one time I expected I could hire people, and did at one time, who could jump into a position in, whether it be trading or organizing things or whatever was needed to be done, and they could just do it. Today, when we hire people, we assume that it's going to take them a couple of years of training to get up to speed. And it's a difficult couple of years for them and for us. And as a result, we are not going to pay as much for a person that we're going to need a couple of, put a couple of years of training into as we would for somebody who walks in the door ready to sit down and go to work. But that's the situation our job market is in the United States today. We're just there. And that explains this very strange conundrum that we're seeing in the market today, in the job market today, where companies across the United States are saying we can't find qualified workers, we can't find enough any kind of workers, but we're not going to raise wages. So we're kind of, it's an interesting thing. We throw in automation, throw in globalization, and we're in a new world. We're in a world where things are not quite what they were before. We're in a world where inflation is unlikely to happen to a great extent anytime in the near future because the forces that would make it happen are just not there. Inflation occurs when people have more money to spend, but they're not creating as much new productive product of some kind or service. And when there's an attempt to force wages up, as we've seen in the west along the west coast and to a lesser degree along the east coast, What happens is the companies in the service companies turn to automation, and the non-service companies tend to do their expansion overseas, which, by the way, is still going on. It's going on to a large degree. It's not, we're not moving jobs overseas. What we're doing is when companies expand, they tend to expand overseas. And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, why don't we do what Donald Trump has suggested? Let's throw in an apprenticeship program where they don't make full minimum wage, but they learn a skill.
Many companies already have that.
Yes.
Some cases apprentices work for nothing.
Yes.
Minimum wage is so low right now that anybody could take on, any reasonable company could take on somebody at minimum wage and train them. I've looked at his proposal, and the only way an apprenticeship program that he's talking about would work would be if the federal government provided funding to pay people to learn things in businesses. Or if he gave a tax credit to the businesses and says, okay, if you hire, and by the way, there's a bunch of those out there right now, a bunch of those programs out there for veterans and a lot of other things, which have had very little effect. When we hire people today, they effectively are apprentices in our business because they don't know what they're doing.
In my business, it involves labor very often.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that I could hire a 16-year-old, for example, for $2 an hour.
Okay.
You know, and teach him how to do something.
Now,
we've got people 20, 25 years old, and they can't do a damn thing.
I completely agree with you. By the way, I strongly suspect you could, now, this would be something, it'd be wonderful to try this out. I'll bet if you offered to hire 16-year-olds at $2 an hour and train them, you'd get nobody show up.
Well, I bet you'd get more than you think, because a teenager sitting at home doing nothing but playing video games, some of them are going to want to do something.
Mm-hmm.
If they have parents to encourage them to work, and if they have a work ethic, they want to go do something.
And you couldn't pay a minimum wage to train them.
No, okay. Because they can't do anything.
All right, I got you. Well, I know all about people who, when you hire them, you can't do anything. We've had a lot of experience with that over the years, but we've been able to pay them. What we tried to do is pay minimum wage to get people to work in an air-conditioned office and learn a skill, and we couldn't find anybody who's willing to work.
Well, you know, if I'm doing mechanic work or welding or something like that, and I have a 16, 17, 18-year-old high school student, he can't do anything except play a game on a computer, but I could teach him a little bit about mechanics or welding or ranching or a lot of things. But I cannot pay him $10 an hour while I'm trying to show him how to do something. You know, so I think that we're really missing the boat.
Minimum wage is up. Minimum wage is not up to $10 an hour, I don't believe.
No, I think it's $7.70.
Yeah, it's $7.70.
In fact, I think the state of Missouri just passed a state law that would prohibit cities from raising the minimum wage above $7.70 an hour.
Yeah.
So
the only reason, I say that is the number of people who are working in minimum wage is really pretty small.
Right.
And particularly here in Central Texas, I've looked at that. You know, and again, you may have a different approach to that. And there are programs where the government will effectively pay you to hire somebody and teach them, particularly veterans. Do you know that?
No, I didn't, but I think they should do that because we have people that are in their 20s or 30s that can't do anything.
You're right. And tell you what, if you talk, and I haven't done this in a year, so things could have changed, but if you contact the Texas Workforce Commission and say you'd like to hire somebody, you'd like to be able to train somebody to do some skills, but you don't want to pay them $7.70 an hour plus benefits while you're doing it, they probably can provide you with a list of targeted people to do that for. Again, we tried to get in on that program, and we couldn't find any takers. And, I mean, in our business, you're working in an air-conditioned office learning what could be a very high-value skill, and we just couldn't find any takers. There's probably exceptions someplace. We've had some interns come in, but they were college students, and they saw it as you know, they actually got college credit for coming and working in our office. And we actually paid them minimum wage while they were there, and it worked out pretty well for everybody. But the apprentice program is already in effect, for example, for veterans. And the problem is it hasn't done much of anything. And that's one of the reasons that there's not a lot of support. It's a great concept. It seemed like it would work magnificently. And I was even privileged to know Undersecretary of Labor, who was in charge of that and under the Obama administration. And she worked her tail off trying to get employers to hire vets who needed training. And she could not, for the life of her, make a dent in the unemployment rate on vets. And
maybe they're waiting too long, and they're old enough to not do that. But I have four sons, and all of them were under the Tatum Apprenticeship Program, which was no minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
But all four of them today can go to work in 10 places if they want to do it.
Yep. And I just completely agree with you. You know, you might there are now. I know there's some businesses that have cut some kind of I don't know what their arrangement is with the community colleges and even with high schools to get people in where they don't have to pay a minimum wage and they can train them. But yeah, I agree that an apprentice program sounds like it would work really well, but it would, in my opinion at least, require a law to be passed. Congress would have to pass a law to make it happen and would have to fund it to some degree. And right now, I'm not sure you could get the dominant party in the House and the Senate to agree that the sun rises in the east.
Well, exactly. And it would have to be regulated. I mean, you can't just throw the door open to people. They'll be hiring 12-year-olds for 50 cents an hour.
Yeah, I completely. You know, I think
do that.
I think it's a good. It is a good. It seems like a good solution, and I looked at it and thought that was really good, and did some research on it, and talked to this person that I know, and she said that they've tried it for select populations across the country, and several different presidents in a row have tried it. And they just can't seem to get it to work. And
just as an example, I'm not talking about me, but I was privileged to go to a vocational high school.
Mm-hmm.
And this was back in the dark ages, understand. But when I got out of there, I was a good welder, and I went to work the next day. And I've taught my son how to weld and how to mechanic and how to do all these things, but when I got out of high school, I knew how to do something. I was making, you know, here again, I'm not talking about me, but I'm talking about the apprenticeship type programs, whether it be in high school or under unions or whatever it is.
I agree with you completely.
Let me get off here. I know a guy's got to have a call-in show here in a little bit.
Okay,
so
you are completely. By the way, you're completely correct. Go ahead, and I'll talk about this a little more once you get off the air.
Thank you.
Okay, bye bye.
And this is Personal Wealth Coach, and we do need to do some commercials here in a minute. But I just want to talk about that just a second. There is a fundamental problem in our system, and I think that the place and the way to do it. The caller mentioned something. You talked about a vocational high school. You know, we sent our best and brightest educators to Europe and Japan following World War II to help them structure a system. Their whole government, you know, with this nation-building thing that President George W. Bush was so down on. I think it worked exceptionally well in Germany, and it worked exceptionally well in Japan. And part of their system over there that's so different from ours is that in the ninth grade, and people gripe about this, but in the ninth grade, at the end of the ninth grade, there's a graduation, and students are looked at and tested, and these tests frighten the pants off of people, but still they're there. And it's determined at that point, are you going to go on to three more years of college preparatory school, which we call high school in the United States today, or are you going to go to a vocational school, or are you going to go do an apprenticeship starting now? And this is in Germany. And they, as a result, if you take a look at their unemployment rate, unemployment is just almost an unknown thing in Germany, and it's not artificial. It's just because they identify that a student is not going to go to college or not going to do well if they go to college. On the other hand, they may be very, very good with their hands, and we have a need for welders. So you're going to go to a school and learn how to be a really proficient welder. And this is the interesting thing about these programs. It's like Texas State Technical Institute, which became Texas State Technical College, I think, in Waco. And it has worked out exceptionally well. We had a fellow talk to our Rotary Club a while back from there, and he's saying basically these people that go to this thing and graduate from their courses generally have jobs 6 months before they graduate. They just walk right out of the school and into a job, because the schools focus on what do companies need. They're co-funded in many cases by the companies. For example, they said the highest demand position, and I would have never thought in 1,000 years, was nuclear technicians, the technicians at nuclear plants. They require a lot of training. They require a lot of schooling, and there's always a shortage, and the people who are there are getting older, and as a result, they set up a program and they built a simulated nuclear power plant control room at the school, and they certify these people and they step right into a high paying job. Now, is it the most exciting job in the world, watching a bunch of dials and knobs and making sure the thing doesn't blow up? Probably not, but there are people who really get into that. You know, there's people who do work. When I go into the, I was in the hospital recently and had some tests, and there's some technicians in there who get paid. I ask them, they get paid very reasonably well in their opinion, and they had to themselves pay to get the technical education. One of them had a college degree. One of them gave me an echocardiogram the other day, has a college degree in music, which with $1.50 will buy you a cup of coffee in some restaurants. She then put herself through, and she really wished that they had told her in school that, hey, this is going to be a wonderful degree. You'll be able to play the piano really, really well, but you won't be able to get a job. And so she put herself then through a school to learn how to be an echocardiogram technician, and she just, there's actually a name for that, but I don't know what, echocardi something or another, and she works good, she gets good wages and works, and there are openings all the time, and she's got more work than she knows what to do. So the issue here, I think part of the problem we're having with our job shortage in the United States today is we just have too few skills that are oriented on what people really need to do, where the jobs are. And we can see that, by the way, in the fact that a lot of people get degrees, borrow money, particularly from private schools, for-profit schools, and at the end of that time period, they can't find a job and they still owe the money. So we need to really rethink. There's two institutions in the United States we really need to rethink. But we don't tend to rethink things in the United States until we face a true crisis, and we may be getting to one of them. One of them is healthcare, and the other one is the public school system. The public school system used to be 9 years. It was expanded in the 3 years that follow that, which we now call high school, was paid for privately. Now we do 12 years of public education. I think at a minimum we ought to go to 14. It takes 14 years of education for the average student to be employable. And we need to rethink the way we do it at that point. We need to rethink it very carefully so that we're not wasting resources educating people and being a piano player when there are no jobs there and the student doesn't realize it. We need to be focused on what jobs are needed in the economy. And if a person doesn't want to go through an education that's free for a job that's needed where they can get a job and they want to pay for it privately, let them pay for it privately. But don't offer a guaranteed government student loan to them to learn something from which they can never become, for which they can never get a job. And that's pretty radical. The other thing is, and I do need to break for commercials here, but I want to say the other one that I think is very important for us to look at is the healthcare system. I recently, as anybody who listens over an extended period of time, you know I had a health crisis last summer. And I've seen, as a result, I've been in and out, I've really become familiar with the healthcare system in the United States, and particularly in Central Texas. This is really amazing to me. I go in and I say, here I am for my appointment. Here I am to do this. What is this going to cost? And they don't know. How can I make a choice as a consumer if they don't know what they're going to charge me? And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jeff. Thank you for taking my call. And you're doing quite well flying solo. Well done. You hit something when you were talking about public education. I was wondering if you might, before the end of the show, how would you address the existing system of Robin Hood for the public school systems in Texas? From what I've been learning about it, I don't really think that's probably a really great way to do our public school system.
Well, actually, we need... And this would probably going to get me burned at the cross someplace, but we have a state standard for schools, and under Secretary DeVos, I don't know if you realize this, there's a big push with the new law to set a national standard for education. It is being really pushed, and everybody's kind of surprised that they thought that the Trump administration was going to back off on that a lot more local control, but they have rejected several states' plans. But there's the new law, I don't remember, it's the opposite of No Child Left Behind. It's basically every child can conceive or something like that. But the law that is on the books right now states that each state must have an education plan and set goals and achieve those goals. Okay, that's the law. We need a statewide tax to pay for education. And if that means that the property taxes across the state go into one pool, and then it's divided up by the number of students who are in schools, that makes sense. School, whether we like it or not, school is no longer local. We really cannot afford to have the state of Mississippi graduating, as they have done for a long time, graduating millions of students who can't read or write. And we can't afford to have one school district in Texas that doesn't have any computers at all and another one that has hot and cold running computers in the state of Texas. We need a workforce that is capable of entering the economy and functioning at a higher level of technology. And that means we need to sit back and rethink the entire thing. Robin Hood kind of points us off in that direction. The Texas Constitution effectively mandates it. But we need to just, in my opinion, embrace it and acknowledge the fact that we have a state education system that's set by the state, The minimum standards are set by the state. There's very little that the local school board of trustees actually has to do with the education, and have it funded at the state level. I mean, that's just Jeff McClure's humble opinion. There's your answer. Okay?
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for calling. And we need to do some commercials here, or public service announcements or whatever we have coming up.
And this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we may be able to get back on the other side with something, presuming that I can figure out how to do this. And we'll be back, Lord willing, on the other side. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is wandering around the cap, the America's cap. Yes, as opposed to America's Cup, otherwise known as Canada, where it's much cooler than it is here, as he's out wandering around someplace in Western Canada and probably having a very good time. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. We were talking about education and healthcare. And at the end, I talked a little bit about the healthcare issue. We really, something has got to give. And I'll be, very frankly, I don't think the Senate's healthcare bill is going to pass. It doesn't make any sense. Even if it did pass, it'd be overturned. Same thing with the one that came out of the House. Whether we like it or not, it is economically in our best interest that everybody have health insurance. Why is it in everybody's best interest? Because one of the reasons that the cost of health care has risen so fast, and I've looked at this every way under the world, is the number of people who are in the hospital and who receive health care, who do not pay for it, they cannot pay for it because they simply don't have the means to pay for it and they don't have insurance. They can't afford the insurance. So the end result is people, particularly younger people, but in some cases older people, who don't have employer-based health insurance, still wind up sometimes in the hospital. They wind up in intensive care. They wind up with extensive medical expenses, and the hospital can't bill them, so it raises the rates for everybody else. And this is happening across the nation. It's damaging to everybody. And because we consider health care a right, and it is a right, in the United States we have laws that say if a person shows up in an emergency room with gangrene in their foot, some serious illness, the emergency room cannot turn them away, which I think is a pretty reasonable law. You probably agree with me that people shouldn't be left to die on the streets because they can't afford health care. Those people generally are sicker than the average person because they haven't been seeing a doctor, they haven't had these things taken care of over time because they can't afford to. And I got a little dose of that. I had a visit to a doctor recently in the Scott and White system, and then I got the bill from Scott and White because the way our system is set up, I actually get the bill. And it was like it was $1,200 some dollars, $1,250, and I got a big discount because I have health insurance. It would have been twice that amount, $2,500. Because I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, okay, routinely we need to do this test here because of your health history and everything else that's going on with you. We did the tests, saw the doctor, and if I did not have health insurance, it would have been $2,500. Well, I will remember when I didn't have health insurance, and $2,500 was more than I made in a month. And I was raising a family at the time. And I can tell you that I could not have afforded that at the time, and I wouldn't have gotten the tests. I simply wouldn't have gone to the doctor. Well, eventually, then, the person who doesn't go to the doctor, who has something wrong with him, winds up in the emergency room and winds up in intensive care, and that person is out of the workplace market, which is expensive. And there, we have concluded in the United States that we don't want people just dying on the street because they can't afford health care. Somebody's got to pay for that, and right now the medical bill pays for it. If the Senate bill were to pass, if the House bill were to pass, or if a combination of the two were to pass as they are today, you could expect a really amazingly high jump in insurance rates. And it's not because anybody in the Senate or the House wanted to raise your insurance rates. It's a simple fact that there would be, if I presume that the Congressional Budget Office, which is headed up by a Republican, among other things, is correct, and they have been pretty correct on this in the past, they say that we'll wind up with about 20 to 23 million people without health insurance who currently are covered under existing law. That would be economically devastating. we need to step back and instead of reacting, saying we're going to ban this or repeal that or do this other thing, take a serious look at our healthcare system and the way it's built and the way it works, which is so convoluted right now. Like I said, I went in and I said, okay, if I get this test, what will it cost? And literally nobody can answer the question. They can't. It's a situation where because of the deals cut with insurance companies and the amount of money that's charged to people who don't have insurance and the amount of money they really charge under other circumstances, literally nobody could tell me if I chose to have this medical test, here's what it would cost. That is a broken system. That is a severely broken system in which I have no input as a patient. You are listening to Personal Wealth Coach. My name is Jeff McClure. We manage investment portfolios for people with higher net worth. And you can contact us off the air at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. We have live people answering the phone. You can contact me at Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. And we'd love to hear from you, even if you just want to send us an email and tell us what you want on the show.
Truth. It's not just.